So as you've discovered over the last couple weeks, and I pray that you've been reading Ecclesiastes for yourself, you've seen that this book is an incredibly difficult book to interpret. One of the reasons that it is so difficult to interpret is because it is like no other book in the Bible. The writer, whoever the writer is, takes on the role like an actor of the teacher. In the Hebrew, it's the Kohelet. I think another interpretation of that word is the collector of thoughts. The one who explores life and its limitations. But instead of exploring life from the perspective of one who is connected with God, what makes this book so difficult is he explores it from the other end, from the perspective of the skeptic, the seeker, the one who knows God only from a distance, who is doing his best to make sense of life from what can be actually seen and experienced with the senses. And with this in mind, he begins his quest to discover life's meaning. And with every bold turn comes up again and again empty-handed. All is hevel, elusive. It's like smoke. It's an enigma, cannot be understood. But the writer who is playing the role of the teacher, he knows what he's doing. And he understands that he must demolish before he can rebuild. And he is leading us through the various experiences of life to show us that without God, everything is grasping at the wind. Everything is hevel. Everything is limited. Our experiences apart from God leave us in a place of absolute uncertainty. If we cannot find reality through wisdom, as he looks at in chapter 1, through objective truth, if I come up empty-handed, exploring everything that there is under the sun through what I can think about, I will now explore everything I can experience with my emotions. Subjective experience. Sounds very much like the day in which we live, does it not? And this is why this book is not only difficult, but why it is so relevant. Because we, like the Kohelet, not like the writer, we tend to give ourselves fully to so many pursuits that in the end break our hearts and leave us wanting. And we must see the limits in these things so that we can press into what actually matters, so that we can discover that the longings of the human heart must be anchored to a central longing, a central desire, which is Christ himself. So with that said, let's look at these first 11 verses because, as I just said, the Kohelet already explored wisdom. He gave himself to wisdom. And he said that the more he learned, the more sorrowful he became. Now he's going to apply himself to a different kind of experience, one that we understand in Portland quite well. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. You already like this part, don't you? Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was hevel. Dang it. I said of laughter, it is mad. It's crazy. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. Of course. Oh, you are so wise. I'm going to get drunk, but I'm going to think clearly about my drunkenness while I'm getting drunk. And how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Oh, what do we have here? Debauchery. The giving of oneself over to the pleasures of intoxication. And those intoxications that are available to us today are manifold. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Hey, if we're not going to do low art, not going to give ourselves to the debauchery of drugs and false euphoric pleasure, let's give ourselves over to high art. Let's give ourselves over to creativity. Let's make beautiful things with our hands. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. How interesting that these verses use so much of the language that is found in Genesis 1 and 2. It's garden language. It's not enough that he's pursued debauchery. Now he's going to play the role of God himself. I'll make myself Eden on earth. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions, herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. There you have the great God materialism before us. It's interesting, hedonism, beauty, creativity, materialism. He goes on, I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man, sexual liberation, sexual discovery. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So the Kohelet goes one character deeper here. The teacher actually now puts on the mantle of the greatest man who had lived in Jewish history, King Solomon, because he wants to give us the perspective from one who has achieved all that one can achieve on this earth. And he says, after all that he has done, I've given myself over to debauchery, I've given myself over to creativity and beauty and aesthetics, I've given myself over to materialism, I have given myself over to sexuality and sexual liberation. And he said, and you know, this is the best. I'm going to enjoy what I have, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's hevel, gone. This is what he has to say. But I think about this in terms of something that our great country put forth in the Declaration of Independence. You know these words well. You should, anyway. We hold these truths, notice, truths, facts, to be self-evident, that men are created equal. I agree with that, yes. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, really? That among these are life, liberty, and what? The pursuit of happiness. Really? And what has our pursuit of happiness led us to? A land that is marked by debauchery and creativity, by materialism, by sexual liberation, by fame. Do we not live in the age in which Andy Warhol himself prophesied when he said that there will be a day when everyone will be famous for 15 minutes? Are we there? This is our culture. And I think it's fascinating to think about those words, the pursuit of happiness, because they are ingrained in the way that we approach existence, how it has shaped our view of ourselves, because our culture is no longer based on any sort of objective truth, objective belief system. The only thing that our culture promotes, and it promotes it with a particular tenacity is that you are the center of your own universe. You are, at the end of the day, all that matters. David Foster Wallace, one of my favorite authors, wrote that 1,000-page book, Infinite Jest, gave a speech a year before he hung himself and said these words: "Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence." Now, this may not have been what our founding fathers meant by unalienable rights, but it is unquestionably how we've come to interpret them. And what sounds like insane arrogance and pride from the lips of David Foster Wallace, I would argue, is simply a man who's honest enough to admit what we all actually think about ourselves. You see, this pursuit of happiness is the driving force that we must learn how to deconstruct as Christians, because it affects how we follow Jesus. Because if we continue to try to hold on to Jesus and live the crucified life, and at the same time maintain this deep-rooted idea that everything you ever wanted, you deserve, and every dream you have ever had since childhood should be fulfilled, you will discover yourself torn to pieces. Because the pursuit of happiness for most of us is driven by a lust. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. For lust, by its very definition, are those desires that have become fixed upon the temporary, which cannot sustain us, and in turn draws us ever deeper into those forbidden territories with the false promise of soul satisfaction. Think about the very words of Mick Jagger in one of the most well-known songs of all rock and roll history. "I can't get no what? Satisfaction." Did you see Mick Jagger when he was? I know he looks like a Muppet now, but man, in his day, that dude was handsome, little rock star, coolest stage presence I've ever seen, bar none. More money than he could even know what to begin to do with. By the age of 20, I think like his first hit record was when he was like 16 years old. And yet, the song that we all sing, why? Because it's true. I can't get any satisfaction. I can find nothing that lasts. Was he channeling the spirit of the Kohelet here? What's going on? Sounds a lot like Hevel. James chapter 4, verse 2, "You lust and you do not have." You pursue these things, these dreams, these ambitions, these desires, some damaging, some good, but when they take the supreme place of our heart's affection, they will always leave us empty. It's not all bad things. It can be good things too. The problem is what is the central drive of our lives? And what the writer of Ecclesiastes is doing is he's giving us the perspective of one who's achieved everything to show us that if that is what you will give your life to, you will come up frustrated. You will sing that song all the way to your grave. And next week we get a look at that too, that the death rate seems to be one per person. It's so frustrating. The limitations pleasure in a pleasure-saturated society is something that we need to move toward with open eyes. The tension of Ecclesiastes is it challenges us. It challenges the ways that we give ourselves perpetually to new ideas, new gadgets, new trends. We all do it. Our style shifts constantly. Our gadgets change constantly. Our tastes change constantly. All of these things, it's because we're constantly pursuing something that will satisfy us, at least for a moment, until we can move on to the next thing. fascinating to me when we take into consideration the very small percentage of individuals that ever make it to the very top, and to read the stories of their miserable lives. And you don't have to go far. Just pick someone that is absolutely insanely famous and rich and wealthy. And at the least, they will be weird. But more than likely, they'll be miserable. I think of people that I myself have looked up to. David Foster Wallace, I love him. I think his intellect is untouchable. One of the most brilliant writers in the last 50 years. And even within this speech that he gave, he's pointing out the reality of his own brokenness, and he's trying to figure out actually how to fix it. And yet he comes to the conclusion, here's a man with intense wealth and a successful literary career, and he's touted by the most important publications in the world, and yet the rope around his neck was where he ended his life. You know, it's devastating too, as he says that if we do not figure out how to undo this obsession with ourselves at the center of the universe, he says it's all a problem in the mind. And he says this is why the head is always the target of every suicide. He says that in the speech. It's fascinating. But you see, no matter how many stories we read about people who make it all the way to the top, and how miserable they are with everything that money could buy and every pleasure that can be afforded them, we still, there's something in us, even in myself, I don't buy it. I'm like, you know, if I had that money and if I had that prestige, if I had that summer home in wherever, Europe, just pick a place, Iceland, Norway, Paris, whatever suits you, you're like, I would be happy. I know myself. No, you don't. You're a liar. You are deceived. But we really do. We hold on. Like, I know I will be happy. I remember this is how I functioned when I was in my 20s. I will be happy when I get the record deal. I got a record deal. Dang it, I'm still not happy. I will be happy when I have a hit single. Well, I never got a hit single. So, see, I don't know. I could have been happy. I might have been happy. See, that's the problem. See, I'm not sure. I might have been happy. The world owed me that dream. I'm the center of the universe. That's how we think when we're really honest with ourselves. And see, the worst thing about it is it's more than just the depravity of our own hearts, because it says that the heart is wicked and deceitful above all things and not to be trusted, and yet we consistently give ourselves over to it. But now we have a culture and a society that is saying that your twisted dreams and desires, which you give yourself fully to, you should. You deserve it. And culture, actually, like one that's pushing someone off the edge of a building, is right behind you saying, you're saying, I think I should jump. And they're like, you should jump. You will be so satisfied if you jump. It's like the woman in Seattle it was like the mid-90s, who was going to jump off the Fremont Bridge to kill herself, and traffic got backed up, and everyone started telling her she should jump because she was making them late, and she did. I feel like that's the same kind of sick picture that actually we apply that to the ways that we believe because of what society has put upon us, the lies of our own hearts. It's like this double, we can't win. Not only are we self-deceived, but we have a society that agrees with our self-deception and says yes and amen to every crazy idea we have. So what do we do with this? This is our morally unstable, self-indulgent society. And you know what society calls it? Progress. Progress. As sexual exploration reaches fantastical proportions, so has sexual dysfunction. Just look at some of the bestsellers on Amazon. The Viagra lie. Why? Why is that there? And is it a lie? See? As wealth is accumulated, debt has skyrocketed. We have more possessions today than any society ever has. Our great empire has provided us with every luxury under the sky. We recognize that, and yet our great country is a country that sits on trillions of dollars of debt. As knowledge has increased beyond measure, seriously think about this. From 1950 to now, we have doubled, tripled, quadrupled the amount of information to the point where all 19 centuries before doesn't even come close if you were to accumulate all the information that the world had ever collected. We're actually doubling that almost every other week. And yet, intelligence has literally plummeted. We're coming close to a new vision of illiteracy. I say I'm reading Moby Dick and people laugh. Why would you read that? Why would you read is really the bigger question in America today. Why would you read when you can watch, pick your show, any show? Lowbrow, low art, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. High art, highbrow. The Walking Dead. I don't know what. The list goes on. As entertainment is available now 24/7, I think it's interesting that we live in a society that has never been more bored or miserable. For anyone who's ever been to Disneyland, which is supposedly the happiest place on earth, we all know the lie that the entertainment has promised us, because nobody's happy there. Nobody. Everybody's miserable. You're standing 2-hour lines. I actually have been thinking about writing an entire book on the lie of Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. We live longer than ever. I mean, except for back in, you know, the patriarchal days when people lived hundreds of years. But, you know, ever since the flood, we're living longer today. And yet, we are perpetually anxious. We're healthier. Man, we're gluten-free, people. And yet, the rise of prescription medication for mental instability is unfathomable. We possess more than we have ever possessed, and yet we are never satisfied. And I think the worst, we're more connected than we have ever been in the history of this world. There is nowhere in the world that you cannot get to within a day. Nowhere. I thought it was weird. I flew from San Francisco to Iceland in 6 hours. So weird. I fell asleep in Los Angeles on the airplane and woke up in Auckland, New Zealand with the help of Ambien, but still weird. We have iPhones and iPads and Facebook and Twitter, and we Instagram every moment as if it's worthy of a historical recording. We present ourselves to our hundreds of supposed friends who follow us. What does that mean? And yet we're lonelier than ever. I think that's one of the saddest things. We've never been more connected, and yet we've never been lonelier. You see, with hearts that are deceived in a society that pushes us deeper into the deception, it is no surprise that we struggle so much with idolatry. Wallace went on in his speech to say this. I think it's so interesting. He was so close to the truth. Actually, everything he said was totally true. He reminds me of the Kohelet. He reminds me of the seeker, the one who can't figure out how to get to this God that he knows is there, but he just doesn't know what to do. He says, we worship these things. He said, listen to this. If we worship money and things, if they are where you tap your real meaning in life, you will never have enough. If you worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die 1 million deaths before they plant you. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid. Worship your intellect, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. And he calls these things, instead of calling them idols, he calls them our natural default settings. Our natural default settings. So insightful. David, why didn't you understand? How could you understand so much and yet not come to the truth? I think he was one of those few bold and brave individuals who is willing to confront the reality of life under the sun. And he saw it for all that it was, and he could not bear the grief of it upon his soul. But what do we do with these desires? You see, we give ourselves to these things. We pursue them. Our country, our society, our culture tells us we're right in pursuing them. Even as Christians, we don't know how to separate our personal dreams. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I counsel people who say to me, I just want to know what the will of God is for my life. I'm like, I don't know. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love others as yourself. Be more specific, please. It's pretty specific. But see, we're driven by these desires, and we connect our desires even to our understanding of God, and we don't know what to do with them. And so we think, what do I need to do? Do I need to become like a Quaker and just eradicate desires from my life? Do I need to become like a Stepford wife? What's happening here? How do I get rid? I'm a man of desire. I'm a man of urges. I need to be doing things. I need to be accomplishing things. Lord, what do I do with my desires? The problem is not the pleasures. The problem is the fact that we make the pleasures themselves the end. The problem is not the desires, the longings of the human heart. The problem is that we don't recognize that the longing to find purpose and meaning is connected to something much deeper than anything this world can offer. But we give ourselves to the immediate, to what is seen, to what is touched, to what can be smelt. I almost said smelt or smelled. We give ourselves to these things. And we think that this is the thing that will bring value to my life, and it doesn't, and then we're destroyed. I like what C.S. Lewis said in The Weight of Glory. He said, our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. It's not about getting rid of desires. The problem is that we're attaching too much meaning to desires that are less than what the central desire is. He says, we are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. And like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased, at least for the moment. And then that pleasure, whatever it is, whether it be an addiction, something that really destroys quickly, or even a false, vain pursuit of finding your purpose in your work, whether it's lowbrow or highbrow, if that's the main thing, I can promise you it'll leave you empty. So what do we do with that? Well, look forward, because the Kohelet gives us a hint. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, he says this. He says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. That's key, one of my favorite verses in the entire Bible. It says so much, and yet there's also so much mystery around it, because he goes on to say, yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. That eternity in man's heart is what Lewis goes on to say in The Weight of Glory, is the central drive in our existence. that there is something in us that says that we are meant for something more, and we know it. I don't have to prove it. It's something that you feel in the depths of your being. And the issue is that because we are driven by an age of what of materialism, what can be actually experienced tangibly with the senses, we try to fill this void that is actually something that's connected to eternity itself, a void that only God essentially can satisfy. He has placed it there to cause us to pursue him, but instead in our fallenness, we misunderstand that longing and we turn it upon things that break our hearts. And this is what he says. Lewis says, if we were made for heaven, then the desire for our proper place is already in us and just simply not attached yet to the true object. He says, the books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located. And you all know what he means by that. I mean, you've all experienced, have you ever had those moments? Have you ever fallen in love? Have you ever watched a movie that moved you, created in you the sense of, I need to do something, or read a book that stirs the imagination to the point that there's this longing and it's insatiable, and the desire and the satisfaction of that thing when you're reading it or when you're watching it or when you're experiencing it, you recognize it's not that thing itself. It's a longing that goes beyond it, behind it, and there's a mystery in it. We can't fully understand it. This is what Lewis is getting at. He says, those books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have not yet visited. Could not say it better. Jesus said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. And we need to understand very clearly, the Christian life is not about having a God who will give you everything you ever wanted and ever dreamed. It's not about some sort of cosmic Santa Claus or cosmic vending machine, as some have made him out to be. And that is formed more by our great empire in which we live. But our empire, just like every empire that has gone before, will decay and it will disappear. America and all of its promises is not the end that we are looking for we are pilgrims in a strange land, and we are merely passing through. God will one day restore this world, and he will one day put right all that is wrong. But if we make the things around us, and we buy into the lie of our culture and our society that this life is all there is, and this life is all that matters, and we give ourselves fully to whether it be pleasure or pursuits or drugs to escape the disappointments or the joys that come naturally in life, if we ever make those things our gods, they will destroy us. For Jesus said, where your treasure is, your heart will be also. And when he said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall never pass away. Listen, for 2,000 years, mankind has tried to silence Jesus, to reverse his predictions, to make this life the one thing that matters. And I would say the only thing that is proven not to be hevel is his words. So how do we dismantle these displaced affections? How do we undo this idolatry within our hearts? How do we silence the lies of a society that is telling us that we are the center of our own universe? How do we come to a place, once again, where the God who placed eternity in our hearts takes the central position in our life as the sole source of our affections? I think it's interesting that when we pursue life and all that it can give apart from God, it falls away and becomes meaningless. But when we start with God, and we begin with Him as the central fact of our existence, and we go into life with that reality, everything then matters. Everything matters. And that is exactly where Ecclesiastes will take us. I just have to remind you of that, because it's so dark until you get to chapter 12. I mean, the guy does not break character. He just leaves you hanging. And then the last three sentences, he gives us that classic Jewish understanding of the fear of the Lord, which is actually connection, relationship with the living God, a God who is not distant and removed or detached, but a God who is present and available and who has moved toward His people. So this is how we dismantle. Think of these words of Paul in Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with Him in glory. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. We have to do this. There's three things I want us to think through in these verses that will give us the way out of the hevel. We've got to begin with attention. See, here it says, you've been raised with Christ. That's the central fact. So set your heart on things above. There you have the first key. Whatever has our attention has us. What is the central desire of your life? What is the primary thing you spend your time thinking about and giving your energies over to? Because as Christians, we begin with an objective fact. Not the subjective experience of our relationship with Christ, but we begin with the central fact of the universe, God's move of grace toward us in Jesus. That's the central fact of our existence as Christians. It's the gospel. The gospel reveals to us a God who has moved toward us, who has sought us. It's not about us seeking God in our own efforts. It's not about us seeking satisfaction through the pursuits of a world that leaves us empty. It's about us recognizing that we are empty and we need God to do something about it. And God has. It's the central fact of the Christian life. God has moved toward you in grace and love through Jesus. And Jesus must be the specific central fact in which everything else flows out of. If not, everything else will go crazy. We need a vision of something truly beautiful. The one thing I ask, David says in Psalm 27, the one thing I seek is to gaze upon your beauty, O Lord. That must be the central desire. Psalm 119, verse 9 says, how can a young man, how can a young woman cleanse their way? By taking heed, by giving their attention to your word. Jesus is the living word. He's the Logos. The scripture is only useful if it brings us into the presence of the living God whom the scripture is about. We must have a center, and so we must give Jesus our full attention. And then we have to bring in meekness. It's not just enough to give attention to this. We need meekness. Because Matthew 5:5, this is interesting. The Kohelet just says, I've pursued everything that the earth has to offer, and I came up empty. But Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they shall what? Inherit the earth. That pleasures aren't to be eradicated and desires aren't to be destroyed. They're just to be refocused through a central desire, Christ. Guys, I'm a Christian hedonist. I love pleasure. I love to enjoy life. But when life and the pleasures that I enjoy surpass my love of Jesus, I'm in trouble. But if Jesus is the central desire, the man, the woman who has God has everything, it's been wisely said. Meekness is a surrender of self-control. Christ has our attention. Now we give him control. When we have surrendered our life and our desires to Christ in meekness, those secondary desires that destroy us when they are primary, they begin to serve that higher purpose. And the thing with meekness is it allows us, we surrender our life to Christ and even our desires to Christ, and he reshapes us. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will what? Give you the desires of your heart. Trust him. The things that I thought I wanted when I was in my youth turned out to break my heart. And when I gave my life to Jesus, I was so scared that he would never give me what I wanted. And he didn't, because what I wanted was a lie. What he showed me was something better. He showed me himself. And when I surrendered my life to him, he gave me new desires. I wasn't picking, at 23, I was not saying, someday I'm going to be a preacher, man. That is the deepest desire of my life. I'm like, this is like the worst possible idea ever. No desire for ministry, no desire for any of that. But in meekness, I gave up self-control. I gave my attention to Christ, and he began to shape me in his likeness, and the new desires, even the lower ones, began to serve that higher purpose. The world is no longer a system that dominates my appetite, but serves the one who overcame it. And finally, it's about power. Because in Romans 1:16, it says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Gentile." Because when we fix our attention on Jesus and we surrender to him in meekness, that releases his power into our lives. And when his power comes into our lives, we now are able to approach life with a new lens and even a new vitality and new purpose. And now everything that was once hevel actually matters greatly. Everything matters greatly. I'm going to close with this quote from Malcolm Muggeridge. He said this, and I think it's so powerful. He says, "I can say that I never knew what joy was like until I gave up pursuing happiness, or cared to live until I chose to die. For these two discoveries, I am forever grateful to Jesus." We don't have to live an existence like the Kohelet, who gives us a vision of life without God. Life with, if there is a God, he is distant and detached and removed. We live from a different perspective. For God has fully revealed himself through the cross, through his Son. And the cross must be the center of our lives, or we will be lost and without equilibrium. Because the cross continues to demand our allegiance, or we must turn from it in utter rejection. Because there are no choices, there's no middle road. Because the cross declares something that is really hard for us to stomach, and at the same time is the sweetest thing our ears have ever heard. The cross declares to us that apart from Christ, we are hevel. But it also declares to us, because it's God that's bleeding there, that we matter to him more than we can even dare imagine. That's the gospel. It leaves us impotent. I come to the Lord and I said, "Lord, I'm hevel, I'm vanity, I'm a vapor, I'm a phantom. Bring substance into my life. Give me something that matters." And you know what he gave me? Himself. And he did it all. See, that's what the Kohelet's doing. He's breaking down our ideas and our pursuits, and he's challenging them, and he's saying, "You must be reduced to nothing before you can be built up into something." Release the lies of who you think you are and be defined by Jesus Christ, who is the only thing that is certain. Amen?